The views and opinions expressed by the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station or Webster Rock Hill Ministries, its management, or other hosts or underwriting sponsors. Programs presented by KWRHLP are for educational and entertainment purposes only.
Welcome to In Tune. My name is Arnold Stricker.
Hey there, Arnold Stricker. Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
You were a little ill last week, weren't you? No, you were a lot ill last week.
I had the flu, and that particular flu bug is a booger.
A booger bug, huh?
It is. I had the headache, fever, joint pain one. Not the upset stomach or the vomiting, but that... You know, I still have headaches, and it's a real hassle.
Yeah, you know, my youngest granddaughter, who's only two. Oh, actually, she turned three on Thursday. Happy birthday, Nadia. she said the exact same thing. And as a child, you know what she was saying? She said, "My head is banging like a drum."
That's correct.
That's exactly what she said was wrong with her.
I felt like there were people on the inside pushing against my brain.
Oh, boy.
And like right in the middle, I'm sure the company that makes Excedrin is doing well
right now
from my perspective.
Wow. Well, we're glad you're back. We missed you.
It's good to be back. InTune is a 2-hour weekly broadcast, and we'll have an abbreviated version today because we're going to be having some interviews with some mayoral and city council candidates.
This is really important. We want the people to know what these folks are thinking because they're going to be with us for the next 4 years on the board, on the panel there. And we want to make sure that we understand who we're voting for and what their values are.
We really hope that you listen in to these interviews. They will be posted, correct, Ellie?
Yes, they will. We're going to put a special campaign page on our website as well as through our Facebook 63119 so that people can go back and listen to the pre-recorded interviews, and that way they can follow through, they can study the candidates and make sure that they make a good decision on April 3rd.
So there will be some today from 12:30, 1:30.
That's right. And then during my weekly wrap program that follows this, we'll have two more interviews. So, you know, today I think we're interviewing Ken Burns, who is a mayoral candidate, Wes Ackerman, and then Laura Arnold and Pam Bliss. Those are three candidates. And then next week will be Mayor Jerry Welch and then the other guys as well.
That sounds great. Now, folks, don't forget, if you want to text us and let us know your thoughts or comments or questions, our in-studio text number is 314-736-4510, 736-4510. So we focus on issues such as education, the arts, housing, justice, crime, faith, finance, and history, their relevance and impact on improving our community and the greater St. Louis area. And I've got to tell you, Ellie, I really had a good time the other night at Steger 6th Grade Center with the North Webster Black History Month program
that was
Dr.
Great.
Howard Fields and staff and students put together. It was very, very encouraging, very enlightening. I knew a lot of the stories that had been told. I was really pleased with the turnout that I saw there.
The turnout was incredible. It was pretty much standing room only at Steger. And, you know, their auditorium is a nice-sized auditorium, but it was packed. And in addition, you still had the children who were in the choir, the ones who did the play, you know, so you still had a lot of behind the scenes people that were there as well. But it was truly a wonderful experience.
You know, one of the things that struck me, and you and I have had this conversation before, as it relates to Douglas High School and the preparation that you got at Douglas Elementary here, and even those students that went to Douglas High School and then matriculated, I love the word, matriculated on, during integration time, that one of the stories especially that was vibrant to me was that a person was getting A's, and then when the final grade came out, got a B.
Yeah.
And Well, you just need to work harder. Well, work harder for what? You know, if you're getting A's. And the fact that, and I mentioned this to my wife, the fact that many people thought at the time, and I think some still do, that for whatever reason, blacks had an inferior education at the time. Now, in Webster Groves, at Douglas High School, that was not the case.
Not the case at all.
Matter of fact, I tell you, Ellie, they probably had a more prolific education than the students at Webster Groves High School.
We really were prepared. And I will tell you, even today, when I watch my mother is a graduate of Sumner High School, and I watch my mother sit down and play Jeopardy. That woman should be on Jeopardy. She could, you know, I mean, she could be the Alex Trebek, surely, because her knowledge base is so great. We're all the time saying, Grandma, how do you know all of this? And she says, well, we studied these things in school. We learned it. I read. I do this. You know, that's a real myth that the education level is inferior.
And I think that myth, I know that myth was part of the Brown versus Board of Education decision when that came down, that, you know, separate but equal, which was struck down, that they were unequal, that for some reason it was the education of the students was less than what it should be. And in many cases, it wasn't. It was greater than many white districts,
students and parents and teachers made up for whatever the shortfall might have been. You know, if it was we needed more construction paper or we needed more scissors or things like that, you know, they seem to have been provided by our parents or, you know, other people who maybe went out and bought 20 pair of scissors and, you know, brought them into the school or something like that. But, you know, we were able to be self-sufficient, self-sustaining, and education has always been at the top of the heap when it comes to the African-American community, because we see education as the way out of poverty, out of oppression, out of a lot of things, so we thought. And that has always been the big push, always. You know, you could have parents who had been sharecroppers, but guess what? They're going to save every penny that they can so that they can send their child to Harvard.
Well, another interesting comment the other night was that there were farmers who lived near lawyers, who lived near doctors, who lived near store owners, who lived near people who maybe worked on the railroad. So everybody was together. And just as I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, that if you look at today's society where desegregation has disrupted that particular model, that now I'm going to make a statement here, mm-hmm. and it may offend some people, and that's why we have the text line 736-4510,
and that's why we give you a disclaimer at the beginning that's right.
I'm wondering, Ellie, and maybe what are your thoughts on this, that sometimes how some people view blacks within inner city schools is that they are less knowledgeable, they're not as intelligent as white students, and that comes from this whole 1954 Brown versus Board thing, that gee, your schools must have been horrible and so you must not have learned anything, you must not be very smart kind of deal, where it's really an ignorance kind of thing. But the fact that that plays into this explosion of the black community where everybody lived together and professional people rub shoulders, white collar people rub shoulders with blue collar people, farmers rub shoulders with doctors and lawyers, and there was a community, and now that's not the case in many places.
It's called the brain drain, and having lived in other countries, I saw the exact same type of thing go on. When I lived in Jamaica, beautiful, beautiful country, people are just tremendously smart, industrious people. But what was happening was that England was coming along and siphoning off the best and the brightest, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and bringing them to England for, you know, nursing or, you know, doctors, those kind of positions. But then, you know, people left with the desire to go and make a little money and come back home. Well, that all sounds great, but what happens is that you leave, you end up meeting someone, you end up buying a home, or something happens that makes you a little more permanent where you were, you know, where you went to, and so you never make it back home. And that has been the case, you know. Colonialization really has done that, where you siphon off the best and the brightest, and then you look at the people that are left and you make the determination based on that, as this is how those people are. You know, you've taken them out of the averaging.
Right.
And now all of a sudden you make that the determination that that's what people are like, because they're like those people, versus you. What about the people that you siphoned off and now you're using in a different situation? But when you have, in like in this neighborhood, when you had professionals living next door to workers, you know, housewives, you had that, you had an example.
Right.
You had an example of what does a person do who gets up every day and drives off and goes to work, versus what do you have of a person who stays home and does this, this, and this?
Right.
Because you needed that. You still needed that housewife, that mom at home. Because when school was out, guess what? She was looking out the door, making sure that we were making it home safely, that we weren't doing stuff, that we weren't being harassed or beat up or, you know, smoking a cigarette or whatever have you we might be doing. You know, and so it made for that sense of community.
And the sense of community in any community is important.
That's right. Exactly.
And I really sense sometimes when I hear people make comments or I observe behaviors, not only around here, but just everywhere you go, how people act and react to other people. It's like many times it's out of ignorance.
Absolutely. And, you know, not understanding people's culture, not understanding really just the whole thought pattern, or understanding the trauma. And Sophia, in our show, The Conversation, we talk a lot about the collective trauma of groups and people, and how that impact of that collective trauma really resonates throughout a community. You know, so if you have a community where everyone is experiencing the same collective trauma, then what you have is a community that figures out how to overcome that. They don't become victims of it. You know, so they look at it and say, we live in segregation. Okay, so what does that mean? Okay, what can we do based upon having accountants and lawyers and doctors and contractors and,
right,
and architects? And we had all of those kind of people, you know, shopkeepers. My dad was in cancer research.
Well,
you know, you now have people that can come together and say, let's figure out the best solution for us. And we did. We had our own firehouse. We had our own schools. We had our own police department. We had our own grocery store. We had our own funeral homes. We had all of these things, you know, that helped us, you know, the development of a credit union because banks didn't want our money. You know, we had barbers, we had beauticians, we had all these people that were examples for us. And they could say, you know what, you can do this. You too can be this. You too can help and make this community stronger and better. Now you start to take away those folks, what do you end up with? You know, people that are discouraged. Because we're not saying that people, that the best and the brightest are all doctors or lawyers.
Right,
but
right.
Whatever, you take people away and then you discourage the development of the community.
You know, and that's why it's important to know your, I would say, know your personal history, know your family history, and also to know your community's history, your neighborhood's history, know your city's history,
that's
know
right.
your state's history. So, and those who don't know their history
are doomed to repeat it.
And North Webster has a vibrant history. I have a confession to make.
Okay.
That, you know, I'm a music person.
Right.
Okay. I have 2 degrees in music, and Lift Every Voice and Sing was a song that was unfamiliar to me.
I find that to be totally unbelievable.
It is. Well, and one reason it is because, all right, for those of you who don't know, I'm white.
Oh, no.
But
Chris, did you know that Arnold is a white guy?
Yeah, I kind of noticed, but...
that's why we pay Chris the big bucks.
And the reason I say that is because this is a very important song in the Black community.
It is everything. You notice that when it's sung, we stand.
Yes.
It's like the national anthem.
It is viewed as the Black national anthem, the official song of the NAACP.
That's right.
So, and we're going to talk about that today because I'm struck by many, many things when songs grab me. Very few songs grab me by the soul. This song grabbed me by the soul, not only by its music, but by its lyrics.
Well, remember, this was a poem.
That's correct.
Okay. This was a poem that was then set to music. And I would say that if I were to meet 100 African-American people from the age of 40 and upward, that we know every word to this song because it was taught to us. I learned it probably in kindergarten. So I've always sung this song and know it and have the sense of the history of it. But you're right. It is one of the songs that if you really break it down and really just study, what is it saying? This is a very deep poem.
Very deep poem. And when it was written, it was written for the anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birthday down in Florida. And it was presented at that time. And matter of fact, when it was written, and I love the names of the guys who wrote it, they remind me of two gentlemen in the scriptures. We have James Johnson, okay, and his brother Rosamond. But his brother Rosamond really didn't go by Rosamond. He went by John. So we have James and John.
James and John, Sons of Thunder.
So James wrote the words, wrote the lyrics, and his brother, Rosamond, he goes by Rosamond, wrote the melody. And they did this very quickly because he didn't want to give a speech. And the song resonated with people. And it wasn't published at the time, but people learned the song
That's
by
right.
rote.
And you know, many people may recognize James by James Weldon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's generally how his name was related. But that's an interesting point that you brought out, that the brother was James and John. You just taught me something new there. The Sons of Thunder.
The Sons of Thunder.
Because
and
this really is a very thunderous song.
Oh my gosh,
and when
yes.
you hear Black people stand up and truly sing this song together, it is sung with the level of pride and understanding of each and every word. And every time I sing it, it's a new level of just expression and understanding of what it means to be a part of a movement, because that's really what this is. This is a part of a movement, and it's not a passive movement by any means.
Oh, no.
It is a revolutionary, it is a call, basically, to understand what we live in, but not to be complacent in it.
Well, it has three stanzas, three verses, for those who are not the aficionado music types.
Oh, music, right, that's right.
And
you got to sing it three times before you get to sit down.
the first verse is very uplifting, very confident. The second verse or stanza is very solemn.
Yes.
Because it's a remembrance of past, but it ends with a glimmer of future. And then the third verse, to me, is a, hey, let's not forget whose we are.
That's right. Whose we are.
We are the Lord's. And matter of fact, it says, lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee. Lest our hearts, drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadowed beneath thy hand, may we forever stand true to our God, true to our native land. Now, there's a couple things I want to do in this hour of our show. I want to talk a little bit more about James Weldon Johnson and his brother, and really some other things that they did, and some other songs. They wrote over 200 songs together. One song, which many people will probably know, but they probably didn't know that they wrote it. I'm not going to mention it because you have to stay tuned. That'll be on the second half of the
okay,
hour, probably.
Good tease.
His song has been done many different ways, many different times. But I want to give kudos to Roland Carter, who is a professor emeritus and at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. And He did a performance with the Winston-Salem State University Choir, and we're going to play a clip of that.
Okay.
Because, and I had to cut the clip down because his arrangement of Lift Every Voice and Sing is a unbelievably powerful, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And then the follicles on the end of the hair of my stand up. It's one of those kind of deals. It's more of what I would call a traditional kind of song and arrangement. So we're going to have like about a minute of the first boisterous part. We're going to have a minute of the solemn part. And just listen to some of the harmonies that he arranged. And then the last verse that is just like triumphant. So we're going to hear Roland Carter's version, the Winston-Salem State University Choir, of Lift Every Voice and Sing. Now, if that doesn't move you, something's wrong with you.
That's right. You have no blood.
That should just grab you by the inside of your soul and turn you inside out.
And you have to really pay attention to the words. I mean, the music, of course, the crescendos, I'm using all those musical terms, you know, really, really just exonerate that whole thought of, you know, the freedom, the need, the cry
mm-hmm.
for freedom. You know, and I think that when we really understand what we're saying is that the end, the last stanza was saying, don't forget who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Don't lose that in the struggle. And that was always and always has been a part of the reality of the struggle, which I call integration, because integration did not mean we all came together and melded. It meant that we gave up, as African-American people, we gave up a lot of what we already had,
right,
that we knew, that we were proud of. We gave it up in order to become a part of white society.
And it's like, who did integration really work for?
Well, it worked for not us.
Right, right.
Okay, I will tell you that didn't quite work for us. And there will be people who will be very surprised that I say that and may be offended by that. But again, it's because of a lack of understanding of what could we really have had if separate but equal was really the case.
Right.
You know, if it was equal, people would want to come on both sides, wouldn't they? You say,
exactly.
Well, I can get over there. I can go over there and do this. I could go, you know, I have options. So that whole thought of that separate but equal was such a farce. But again, when you understand the pride that goes along with this kind of a song, the strength, you know, it should be sung every day, to be honest with you.
And some sang, some did the Pledge of Allegiance, the Star Spangled Banner, and then sang Lift Every Voice and Sing as part of their daily routine at
That's
the beginning
right.
of each day at school.
And it strengthens.
Absolutely.
It does. It strengthens.
So I would encourage our listeners to get to know, especially those who don't know the song, to get to know the song, to read the lyrics, the three stanzas, the three verses, and listen to a couple of different kinds of songs that are going on and arrangements of that. We'll be right back after the break. Stay tuned to InTune. Back to In Tune. This is Arnold Stricker with Ellie Wharton, and if you've been tuning into our first half hour, we talked about Lift Every Voice and Sing. We have something else, Ellie. It's a different arrangement than the one we just listened to. We just listened to Roland Carter's orchestral, of course it wasn't an orchestra, but it has been transcribed for orchestra. As a matter of fact, that's a real powerful one. I heard a recording of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra with a Cincinnati Mass Choir singing that. It was like crazy. This is an upbeat version. Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
I'm holding on to my seat.
Our listeners may acknowledge the voices of Al Green and Denise Williams.
Oh,
So you get a little different flavor. And you go on YouTube, you can hear a lot of different versions. My point is this. Everybody has the style of music that they like. The most important thing, you know, we sing melodies, we remember words, and the words of the song are the same. The melody is the same. The tempo may be different. The arrangement may be different. But what you have to understand is the core of what the song is asking and what the core of the song is telling. I want to read a couple of verses from the second stanza. Yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet come to the place for which our fathers sighed. Excuse me. So how many times are when you're tired, can you say you have a steady step?
Right. And that even though our feet are weary, the step is still steady.
Now that's very unusual. And that says there's a resilience and there's a fortitude in which you're moving forward.
That's right.
And then we have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered.
Again, really painting a picture of a depraved kind of environment that we still continue to trudge through with a steady beat. You know, so it's important that when we look at this in the context of what we look at this, we realize that this is a cry of resilience.
That's correct.
Not giving up, not backing down, but continuing to move forward and be resilient.
Now, I want to tell you how important this song was. I've known Augusta Savage as I haven't known her personally, okay? I've known of her work. She was a sculptress and very famous back in the Harlem Renaissance. She was commissioned to create a sculpture for the New York World's Fair, and I've known about this sculpture, the harp, but I didn't know that the work was influenced by the song we just heard, Lift Every Voice and Sing. So she was a longtime member of the Harlem arts community. And some people may recognize Jacob Lawrence, Marvin Smith, some names like that. But what's interesting is it was exhibited outside the Court of Contemporary Arts. And for those of you who have not seen the sculpture or a picture of it, it depicted a group of 12 stylized black singers in a graduated height, just like a harp that symbolized the strings of the harp. And the sounding board was formed by the hand and arm of God, and a kneeling man holding music represented the foot pedal. The interesting thing about this is the sculpture was destroyed, like many of the works back then, because nobody was willing to cast it in bronze. So there are some smaller versions of it. And take a look at that, because Augusta Savage, she's not well known as she should be known. She did some other plaster sculptures, one of her nephew, Ellis Ford, which is regarded as a very unique work of hers. She also did some work in Paris and returned and helped some aspiring artists. So she was really moved by that. Now, the Sons of Thunder. Now, we're not talking about James and John from the scriptures now. We're going to move them, James Weldon and John Rosamond.
I still think that's amazing. But I never knew that.
Your mother had a good clue on what was going on.
She did, because when you made that, just like you had never heard the song before, and I was incredulous of that. When you told me that, I was like, wow. As many times as I have sung this song, I never put that connection together.
Well, you know, their mother was a musician and taught them both when they were children. And want to give a little background on them, because they collaborated, as I said earlier, for over 200 works. They were both very well known. So here's a little on James Weldon, and most people know him, author, educator, lawyer. He was born in Jacksonville, Florida, 1871. His brother, John Rosamond Johnson, became a composer. And as I mentioned, they were educated by their mom. She was a musician and a public school teacher. So public school teachers... Hang on out there.
That's right.
So they got this love of music from their mother. He enrolled at the age of 16 at Atlanta University.
So that means that he was exceptionally sharp.
Exceptionally sharp. It's like, don't be sharp, don't be flat, just be natural.
Just be natural. Oh, yeah, I've heard that joke before.
So he also got a graduate degree from them, but in the course of his studies there, he got a law degree, or he took the test for the bar, and he was the first, he was the first African-American admitted to the Florida bar exam since Reconstruction.
My goodness.
That's big deal.
That is huge.
That's big deal. His father was head waiter at a hotel, which was like one of Florida's first winter resorts. And his father imparted on him this importance of classical education, for which Atlanta had a reputation. But one of the things that was imparted that is important for young people to understand today is that academic training is a trust. It's not something you keep to yourself. He knew he was expected to devote himself to helping Black people advance. So when you get your education, what do you do with what you have? Do you make a living? Do you earn money? Or do you help promote unity amidst diversity?
Well, we also have to look at the American lifestyle. See, the American lifestyle is one built on, I did it myself. I did it my way.
I.
That's right. All about the I.
Remember, we talked about me, myself, and I, the new Trinity.
That's right. Exactly. And so with a culture being that, you know, you basically don't look back. You don't reach back. You don't pull from behind you and bring, you know, you don't open the door and let everybody else come in that hasn't had the opportunity but has the talent. We're built on the concept of I did it. I made it. I am a self-made person. And when you start to say, you know, what you have the obligation to turn back around and to bring others with you. You know, then that is a very foreign concept in this country because it almost sounds a little bit like socialism, you know, like we all got to get along, we all got to come along, you know. But in a culture, when you have an I, me, my culture, that to me is very dangerous because then you never feel like you have an obligation.
Right. You're always taking rather than giving
back.
Than
giving back. And unfortunately, a lot of people wait to give back once they've retired. Well, I've retired now, so now I can give back. You know, it's kind of like I always tell people about tithing, and that's always a controversial subject. But I believe that you haven't begun to give until you've returned your tithe. Now, your tithe may be your 10% of your time, 10% of your money, 10% of your talent, whatever. But if you haven't returned something first, you haven't begun to give.
You know, about that is God doesn't want your money.
That's right.
He wants you.
And he wants your obedience. He wants your
right.
willingness and your acceptance.
Right.
The rest of it is all a part of that. You know, but again, all of the talents that we have, the times that we have, you know, that's why it's important to engage young people while they're young so that they have the spirit of volunteerism and the spirit of giving back. But what's happening is that we're raising children to be entitled. I deserve this. I should get this. I want this, even though I can't afford this. So what happens as a result of that? We're always reaching out. We always have to have. We're going to buy impulsively. We're going to rack up debt. Oh, my. We almost sound like the government. You know?
Yeah.
But that's what happens. And then you look back and then you look back at, because you've taken everything out, now you look back at blighted communities, families that where the best and the brightest have decided to go on and those who are still struggling are left in the pit.
Disintegrated.
Yes, exactly. So we have to look at the struggle and always look at it from the standpoint of, just like this says, out of the gloomy past. We're not sticking in that past. We're not going to let that be the thing that mires us down. Okay, but now we can stand and then we see the gleam. We see the gleam of that bright star. We know that there's something that's going to lead us forward and we have faith. And that's the key, is that we have faith despite all these other things that have happened to us. We still have faith that God is going to protect and guide us.
And hope.
That's it.
That's what it's about in this particular song.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So while James is getting his law degree, his brother is going off to the New England Conservatory of Music. and he's getting his he travels over to London. They collaborated on several songs together. They wrote some operettas. They wrote some matter of fact, they wrote several quote unquote white musicals, Sleeping Beauty and the Beast in 1901. Humpty Dumpty in 1904. They collaborated on Hello Paris in 1911 with another individual. Matter of fact, Rosamond, he often toured with his own ensembles. He often was in the plays that he and the musicals that he wrote. And he died in 1969. But I bet our listeners may know this next song that they both wrote. And it was actually written in the early teens, but it didn't become famous until later on in a movie that has a title with St. Louis in it. Take a listen.
Down in the jungles lived a maid, a royal blood, though dusky shade.
A marked impression one she made upon a Zulu.
From Madame Bulu.
And every morning he would be down underneath the bamboo tree,
awaiting there his love to see.
And then to her he'd sing.
To her he'd sing.
Vamp.
Both the same. I like to say this very day, I like to change your name, 'cause I love you and love you.
So those of you who know that movie, 1945, Meet Me in St. Louis, or as some people say, St. Louis, that was Judy Garland, and I'm stand corrected, they wrote that song in 1902.
2 years before the World's Fair here.
Correct. And it's called Under the Bamboo Tree. So we're talking about some... These guys were not just, oh yeah, we lucked into the song and we did this. This was Rosamond's life. He was a really, really good musician. Now, if you look at James Weldon, what did he do right after that? Okay, he's helping his brother write these songs. In 1904, he's the treasurer of the Colored Republican Club. He gets elected president of the club a year later. In 1904, he helps Teddy Roosevelt in his presidential campaign. Roosevelt appoints him to be the consul in Venezuela and then in Nicaragua. And during that time, he gets married, okay? And he ends up coming back after he gets married to Grace Nail. They return, and he becomes more involved in his writing. He becomes more involved in his poetry. He becomes more involved in writing novels. He lived in Harlem. He also lived in Washington, D.C. So his reputation as a writer becomes more well-known for his poems and novels, his anthology. He becomes more involved in civil rights activism. So in 1917, he's involved with the NAACP as like a field secretary, goes to Memphis, Tennessee, investigates a brutal lynching that was witnessed by thousands of people. He reports on this atmosphere. He comes back. He writes a report about the economic corruption and forced labor and censorship of the press and racial segregation that's going on in Haiti. And he ends up being selected and chosen as the executive secretary, the first African-American to be chosen as an executive secretary of the NAACP, 1920. He does that for 10 years. He comes back to Washington, still working in Harlem. He wrote a book, the Book of American Negro Poetry, published that book, published and edited the Book of American Negro Spirituals, published his own poetry book, his collection, God's Trombones, Seven Negro Sermons in Verse. Continued writing, published a sociological study book, Black Manhattan. His Negro Americans, What Now? Was a book-length address addressing advocating fuller civil rights for African Americans. So he returns to education. He accepts the chair, the Spence Chair of Creative Literature at Fisk University in Nashville. They created this position for him because they recognized his achievements during the Harlem Renaissance. He was appointed the first African-American professor at New York University, where he taught several classes in literature and culture, and had an unfortunate accident in 1938 while vacationing in the state of Maine. His car was hit by a train, and he died.
Wow.
So
that is quite a history.
You know, when I listened to this song the other night, and I was reading the words, and then I looked all this up, I was like, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me.
There's so much sitting here in terms of information and knowledge. And when you start to read the history of this man, to me, it almost goes, and it kind of goes back to this whole thing of how we look at certain things and we just do things by tradition. Mm-hmm. But not understanding the depth of that tradition. You know, where did this come from? How did it flow out of him? And again, like you said, they didn't just stop here. This wasn't, you know, oh, they happened to the write, you know, a poem that was ended up being very, very successful, and that was it. You know.
Yeah, let me write a tune to that poem, brother.
Yes, exactly. But there is so much more to the authors, the creators, the lyricists, the musician, that if we understand that part of the history, then the song makes even more sense, makes greater sense, and we understand it as a complete. And, you know, and too often we do shortcut ourselves by not doing the total review of history. Where did this come from? What was going on at the time? Why did they write this? And now it tends to make more sense versus just, we're going to just stand up and sing this song. If we get the lyrics right, okay, everything is good. Let's sit down now. That becomes tradition. It's almost kind of like the Star Spangled Banner, if you think about it. Most people have no clue as to what the history behind that song is. And if they did, there would be a different level of respect for it.
I think you really hit a nail on the head when you were talking about how we do things kind of out of remote control.
Yes.
And we're not thinking about the essence behind things. We're not thinking about the why or the struggles about where we are today and what we can do today because of those who have gone before us.
As you were talking about, this was Rosemond, John Rosemond had all of these other accomplishments. Ambassador to Haiti or ambassador to Nicaragua. I mean, we have to think about what was going on at that time. And we're talking like the early 1900s. And the president at the time, Roosevelt, right?
Correct. Teddy.
That's right. Do you realize that he was the first president to ever travel outside of the United States? And where did he go? He went to Panama to look at what was going on with the Panama Canal. He was the first president, and they have pictures of him down in Panama being shown the construction area of the Panama Canal. Knowing that all of that kind of history helps us to have a greater understanding of what were people doing, why were they doing it, and looking at the fact that there were Black people doing exceptional things.
Absolutely.
Exceptional things way back then that we do not hear about.
And were integral parts of what was going on in spite of some of the things that were happening to them.
In spite of. That is the key. In spite of. And so when you look at, when you go back to Reconstruction, you look and you go forward, you see that there are so many contributions that the African American has made. That's why having a Black History Month is almost like an insult.
Well, it is. And I looked at this and I was like, oh my gosh, how many people know about this information? That's why I brought it today.
And I think that was good because you have shared information with me that I did not know. I'm sure that most of our listening audience did not know. And this is what I hope that the school systems would begin to work with in terms of teaching people not just the surface things, but digging down deep, giving people what I always call the roots of what everything is. Then it all makes more sense.
It all ties together.
It ties together. And then that way people in this country can see how you can't just say that's Black history versus white history versus Chinese history versus Hispanic history. you know, or immigrant history, because America is a compilation of all histories.
That's correct.
And we have to be able to accept it, the good, the bad, the ugly, the black, the white, the yellow, the green, the brown.
Red and yellow, black and white.
That's right. All of those have to be, come together in order to make the red, white, and blue.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, a great summing up of where we need to be in our schools. As to, and this is what I gathered from even the North Webster celebration the other night, the importance of, and this goes back to a biblical perspective too, the importance of passing down stories, passing down your heritage, passing down the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I remember my own family, man, there's things like, no, we don't talk about that. No, we don't talk about that relative. Like, why don't we talk about that relative? And so now with my parents gone, having to dig up some of these things and uncover and try to find out, well, what was the deal? You know, what was, okay, so what, big deal? Okay, you find out what was, well, back then it was a big deal.
It was a big deal, that's right.
And to us right now in our generation, that's not a big deal. But it's like there's gaps in people's history. There's gaps in people's background that, why am I this way? Or why did we do this with this part of the family and we didn't do this with this part of the family? So the passing, the oral tradition, huge. Of your family's history, of your community's history, of your culture's history.
Yes. It goes back to even when we have spoken about the Del Mar Divide.
Yes.
And people coming in, if they don't understand certain histories of this country, of this city, of St. Louis, you know, and you start to look at the Del Mar Divide, you start to look at the housing covenants, you start to look at all of those kinds of things, and now you say, oh, wait, I understand now why we have this situation because of certain legal things that were put in place to hinder the movement of, then you can understand why things are like how they are today.
That's the whole point of this show, where we focus on all of these things and their relevance and impact on improving our community and the greater St. Louis area. Where we've come from, what is that doing to us now? How can we change that? Now that I understand that, I know why people think the way they do, to some degree, maybe. That's what our listeners may think, but it's understanding. So, okay, now that I know this, I can deal with this or I can do something about this. So that's the whole point of our show. And I really encourage our listeners to stay tuned to future shows. We're on Fridays from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Now, abbreviated today and abbreviated next week because of the interviews with the mayoral and city council candidates. So want to make sure that you check us out and keep us on your schedule.
In other words, be in tune.